this is Dr. Bob Evans, and welcome to our podcast, Parental Alienation from Couch to Courtroom and Beyond. We will discuss the resisting and refusing dynamic, commonly referred to as parental alienation, how you'll know it's happening in your case, and what can be done about it. Parental alienation can cause stress and trauma in high-conflict cases. These podcasts focus on how attorneys and mental health professionals can support families and children. Well, welcome back. This is episode 23, and I know it's been a while, and I am sorry that I haven't been able to do these more frequently. But on the other side of that is I've been able to do a lot of testimony around the country and try and help folks with their cases. So one of the things I really started to get interested in, and I talk about this in one of my training programs, actually some of the training programs, the whole idea of looking at social psychology. Now, one of the things that's a real big difference is most people, most professionals in the forensic business, most mental health professionals in the forensic arena are clinical psychologists, mental health professionals, licensed and family therapists, mental health counselors, certified clinical, licensed clinical social workers, etc. And most of these professions really tend to focus on the individual, what's going on within the person. And so one of the things that social psychology do, social psychologists like Philip Zimbardo, Albert Bandura, these are old names in the business, but they've researched a number of really interesting phenomena that actually apply to the parental alienation situation. And so I want to talk about some of their studies and some of the history because it's just simply fascinating. And you won't hear many, quite honestly, if any, other professionals talking about the research from decades ago that apply to this phenomenon. The areas particularly of interest is what I'm reading out of a book from Philip Zimbardo, Investigating Social Dynamics, De-Individualization, Dehumanization, and the Evil of Inaction. One of the phenomena that we know, one of the tactics of an alienating parent is to encourage a child or children to call the rejected parent by their first name. And that's kind of, at best, by their first name. I've had cases where they call the rejected parent a lot worse than, him, her, by their first name. They call them some pretty bad expletives. And so people kind of blow over that. They kind of think, well, that's not such a big deal. I mean, even most kids, even in non-divorce situations, most children will play around with calling a parent by their first name. But they get corrected very quickly. You can't call mommy or daddy Tom or Fred or Mary or Sue. That's unacceptable in our society, in our culture. Why? Because that's a downgrading of that parent from a parental role to that of a peer, or even maybe even worse, to maybe a neighbor, because you call the neighbors by their first name. And so now we're going to call mommy and daddy by their first name. And people think, well, that's not such a big deal. Well, it turns out it is a big deal. And if the child goes beyond the first name and start to use some, as Zimbardo was talking about, and Stephen Cece out of Cornell, they talk about stereotypes. And what happens in these cases, these forensic cases where there is alienation, the targeted parent is stereotyped. He's a drug addict. He's a deadbeat. He divorced us. I never really considered him a father. I never had a good time with that parent. Same with the mother. I've never considered her my mother. She's not really my mother. I don't really need her. For the last 15 years, she's never done anything for me. And so their argument is a dehumanization, a downgrading of a parent. The key is so much so that when you have the alienating parent, the favorite parent, needs to step in and stop that. They need to correct it. You can't talk to your mother, your father that way. That's unacceptable. And so let's look at some of the research that goes on in this phenomenon and how incredibly dramatic these types of procedures, stereotyping, labeling, dehumanizing, can have on a child based on the research that we know that's been done for decades.
So reading from Zimbardo, and then so he talks about the dehumanization and moral disengagement. And I think about this in terms of children who are rejecting a previously loved parent. Is somewhat of it is through the process of dehumanization. And there is a moral disengagement by some children, depending on their age, of course. And what about the favorite or alienating parent? There clearly is a moral disengagement. So Zimbardo talks about the dehumanization is the current construct in our understanding of man's inhumanity to man. Parent alienation is an example of humans' inhumanity to other humans, i.e. people who had a previously loving relationship in most cases. They were married. Dehumanization occurs whenever some human being considers other human beings to be excluded from the moral order of being a human person. You know, you're no longer human. You're an alcoholic. You're a drug addict. You abandoned us. Some of the names these kids have called the rejected parent are just unbelievable. So the objects of the psychological process lose their human status in the eyes of their dehumanizers, in our case, obviously, children and the alienating parent. So by identifying certain individuals or groups more often as being outside the sphere of humanity, dehumanizing, making them, it just suspends the morality that might typically govern reasoned actions toward our loved ones, our parents. Dehumanization is a central process in prejudice, racism, and discrimination. Dehumanization stigmatizes others, attributing to them a spoiled identity. For example, the sociologist Irving Goffman, he described the process by which those who are disabled are socially discredited. They become not fully human, thus they're tainted. So under such circumstances, it becomes possible for normal, morally upright, even usually idealistic people to perform acts of destruction, acts of destructive cruelty. Not responding to the human qualities of other people automatically facilitates inhumane actions. I think parental alienation, children rejecting a parent, is an inhumane action. The golden rule then becomes truncated, do unto others as you would. It's easy to be callous or rude towards dehumanized objects, to ignore their demands and pleas, try and reason with them, to use them for your own purposes, even to destroy them if they're irritating or they're bothering you. So that's the big problem with changing people's names, changing parents' roles, stereotyping parents, and it just keeps going on. We're talking about a process that the social psychologist Bandura, Zimbardo, are talking about how do some of the human tragedies, if you will, in our history, then, you know, Holocaust, May Lai incident in Vietnam, etc. And I'm taking that phenomenon. I realize that's an extreme example, but that's the process is the same, the dehumanization of a targeted parent. So in Albert Bandura designed a powerful study, and this is really interesting, a powerful study that really demonstrates the power of dehumanizing labels to foster harm against others. He had 72 male volunteers from a nearby junior college, and he divided them into three-member, quote, supervisory teams, whose task was to punish the inadequate decision-making of other college students who were allegedly serving as a group of decision-makers. The real subjects of the study were the students playing the role of the supervisors. On each of the 25 bargaining trials, the supervisors heard a decision-making team reported to be in an adjacent room, supposedly formulating collective decisions. So the group in a classroom was supposedly making decisions, and the supervisors were giving information they used to evaluate the adequacy of the decision on each trial. Whenever a bad decision was made, it was the job of the supervisor to punish the error by administering a shock. And in the 1970s, there was a lot of studies, or earlier, a lot of studies using shock as a measuring tool. They could, and they're not really shocking them, they're pretending to shock them, that they could choose the shock intensity from a mild level of, let's say, 1 to a maximum level of 10. So the supervisor had a choice of the choosing the intensity of the electric shock that was going to be administered. So the supervisors were told that the participants from different social backgrounds were included in this project to increase its generality. But each group of decision makers was composed of people with similar attributes. This was done that the positive or the negative labels soon to be applied to them would hold to the entire group. So the researchers varied 2 features of this basic situation: how the victims were labeled and how personally responsible the supervisors were for the shocks that they administered. The volunteers were randomly assigned to 3 conditions of labeling: dehumanized, humanized, or neutral, and 2 conditions of responsibility: individualized or diffused. First, consider how the labeling was imposed on its effects, and this is really key. Then we'll talk a little bit about the responsibility variations. After settling into the study, each group of participants believed that they were overhearing an interchange over the intercom between the research assistant and the experimenter about the questionnaires the decision makers had allegedly completed. The assistant remarked in a brief aside — this wasn't even a direct comment made to the supervisors — a brief aside that the personal qualities exhibited by a group confirmed the opinion of the person by whom they had been recruited. In the dehumanized condition, the decision makers were characterized as an animalistic, rotten group. The humanized condition, they were characterized as a perceptive, understanding, and otherwise humanized group. No evaluation references were made of the third group or the neutral condition. Now, again, there was no interacting with the shock victims. They didn't know that, they didn't watch them. They couldn't make such evaluations personally or evaluate their adequacy. The labels were secondhand attributions made about other young college men. Supposedly, also volunteers functioning in an assigned role in a situation. So did the labels have any effect on how these college students punished those who were allegedly supervising? Indeed, the labels stuck and had a big impact on the extent to which the students punished their supervisees. Those labeled in a dehumanizing way as animals were shocked most intensely, and their shock levels increased linearly over 10 trials. It also climbed higher and higher over trials, up to an average of 7 out of a maximum of 10 for each group of participants. Those labeled nice were given the smallest amount of shock, while the unlabeled neutral group fell in the middle of these 2 extremes. What's fascinating is how frequently do children overhear a label for a target or rejected parent, as opposed to not being told directly. One of the big questions that comes up frequently is, well, in bad mouthing, is the bad mouthing, made to the children directly? We have any evidence of that? Well, if you're coming from a household where, the alienating parent is very negative towards the other parent and very vocal about it, it's a high likelihood or a very strong possibility that the child's going to overhear some of the negativity being communicated by the favorite or alienating parent. That just makes sense. Our history in the United States has a long history of using stereotype labels to affect things that we would find very seriously unconscionable. One of the studies that Zimbardo talked about, one of the phenomena he's talked about was during the 1920s, 1927 to the 1940s, more than 65,000 American citizens were sterilized against their will during an era when eugenic advisors advocates use scientific justification to purify the human race by ridding it of all those with undesirable traits. Kind of expected that from that point of view from Adolf Hitler, but not from one of America's most revered jurists. Oliver Wendell Holmes ruled in a majority opinion, 1927, compulsory sterilization laws, far from being unconstitutional, were a social good. He quote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." So, and it goes on, there's other studies to talk about that students at the University of Hawaii in the 1970s basically endorsed a final solution to eliminate the unfit from our culture, even if it included their own family members. So there's a long history in the United States and the United Kingdom for, oh, as Zimbardo calls it, a war against the weak. And what we deal with in an alienation case is basically a war between one side of a family against the other, and that's really unfortunate. Well, this is a brief podcast. I wanted to really share this information because I'm looking more and more into social psychology and social psychology experimentation that basically is quantitative in terms of the phenomenon I find of parental alienation, stereotyping, bad-mouthing, targeted, rejected parents has a significant effect on children, has a significant effect on the relationship between a parent and a child, and it really needs to be taken very seriously and needs to be stopped. Zimbardo goes on and talks about the evil of inaction. The evil of inaction in this situation is the favored or alienating parent allows this to happen. You don't, in a normal family where there's none of this, there's no divorce, there's no disillusion, the child isn't rejecting anybody, it's kind of innocently espoused by the child by calling a parent by their first name, it's corrected immediately. You're not going to call mommy by her first name, you're going to call daddy by her first name, that's unacceptable. Let's get back on track. And that's what we need to do in these cases. Listen, I appreciate your tuning in, and I hope that you found this interesting. Go to NAOPAS and you'll see some of the other courses that we have up there. And I hope you enjoy those. Thank you very much. You all take care.
Thank you so much for joining us today. For more information on this topic, please visit www.drbovans.com or www.naopas.com. We offer classes for both legal and mental health professionals to help educate them on the signs and strategies of parental alienation and how to move forward for a healthier environment for the children of divorce. Please visit www.naopas.com and sign up for our courses and use coupon code PODCAST for a 50% discount.